Good evening. This is Jonathan Behrendt, and thank you for the positive feedback that I got during the week. A lot of interesting emails. Just to review for a moment, last week we heard from Mike, who was an adult, who said he was 85% healed with his selective mutism and social anxiety. And the reason I had an adult talk was especially for the parents who want to invest in the belief that the child will grow out of the problem. In essence, the problem gets worse with time, and that's something I'm going to address a little more specifically tonight. You heard from Lynn, who used the word cure. That was her word. Remember, conservatively and ethically, I am very careful when I use that word. But she used that word to describe the status of her daughter, who is now age 8, and the work that we did was entirely over the telephone through corrective parenting. And we heard from Ellen, whose adult son, I worked with her son when he was young, a special needs individual whose selective mutism is also substantially better at this point. So you know that there is hope, and hopefully we instilled some belief in you. Now, there's a lot of stuff that we want to do tonight. First, I have to read what may be the best email I ever got, and it's from Simpsonville, South Carolina. Question for Jonathan. My daughter has been diagnosed with selective mutism, and I was wondering if there were any quick remedies or one particular event that can take place on my behalf to help break her of her anxiety. Ah, magic. We seek magic. I have mixed reaction when I hear this, okay? On one, I have to have a sense of humor because, you know, it's hard to open the magic store. On the other, there's a very serious thing that people are not understanding what selective mutism is all about. Selective mutism is not a cold that simply goes away. Selective mutism is a severe form of social anxiety, which is a precursor to the reality that the person is going to be more susceptible to social anxiety and social avoidance and overdependence as life goes on. It's a serious thing, and obviously there are many different degrees of the problem. But in order to try to deliver as much magic, at least as close to magic as can possibly be done, we have on the phone my patient who did not speak last week because she's calling from Miami. Her name is Delia. And the hurricane wiped out the phone system last week. So I want you to listen very carefully, because she has a great story, to Delia, who's going to describe where her child was, where he is now, how long it took to achieve the results, and what she did. You ready, Delia?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Delia, can you tell the listeners, and you have about 100 people on the line, can you tell the listeners where your son was at when we first started talking?
When we first started talking, when we first met, Zachary was a selected mute child who wouldn't talk to anyone except to his sister, to his father, and to his stepfather. He wouldn't talk to me or to anyone else. He was always very quiet and lonely. He will avoid people around him. He will put his head down or hide behind my back if someone says hi or asks him a question. He will look away if another child of his age will invite him to play. Also, if I have any visitors in my house, he will go to a corner of the house and stay there until the visitors are gone. Zachary wouldn't do anything by himself.
And Delia, what was going on in school?
He wouldn't talk to anyone. He would just stay in the seat looking at the teacher, but he wouldn't work. He wouldn't do anything.
Okay, so I imagine this situation caused quite a bit of concern for you.
Yes, it creates. It makes me sad.
You did a very good job in describing where he was. Where's he at now?
Oh, forget it. I would say when we started our session, we started our sessions 2.5 months ago. And by the third session, Seth was already talking to me. This is when I used the word magic. It was like magic. The way the doctor, you have taught me to talk to him, is like he broke the glass door that has Zach trapped behind it. The system woke him up. I saw through his eyes like a window of his brain get open and let Zach's voice out.
You're very descriptive tonight.
Yeah.
And I have to say that Delia has a lot of courage because, you know, she's faced this problem directly. And Delia is Spanish. And in all honesty, in some of the telephone work, I've had a hard time understanding some of what she said. But she was so motivated that we were able to compensate for this language barrier. And she got the basic facts down and faced the issues directly. And what she just said was in less than a handful of therapy sessions over the course of about 2 months, the selective mutism has begun to be reversed. So just very briefly, Delia, what did you do?
Well, let me tell you real quick. He talks to me now, and there is no more nonverbal communication. He interacts with me like any other child. What I did, I learned to stop enabling him. I make him think by himself. I start giving him responsibilities. I stop answering for him. I stop reading his mind. I stop talking for him and figure things out by himself. I gave him, like you have told me, a matter of fact way to live. It's either this way or, you know, there's consequences. I learned to freeze the moment by asking him a question and giving him some time to respond. I told him to be independent. I told him to be more initiative. And I told him to take decisions by himself.
Okay, now you just heard. Delia, thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, you just described everything really, really great. You did a before and after and a how. And what Delia just described, for the people who are listening carefully, is she just described the methodology. But in the key word that she used was she learned how not to enable. So for all of you people who think that the answer is to take your 6-year-old, your 8-year-old, your 10-year-old child to a therapist to treat the child, you're mistaken. In a conversation that I had with a new patient last night, who, by the way, has an important legal issue, Mark, that I want you to answer down the road here. In the course of the conversation, she was saying, it's not about me, it's about the child. And I said, no, it's about you. It's about the parents. And if parents, if you can get that, you're more than 50% of the way there. Okay, again, Delia, thanks a million. Now, one of the most important things is medicine. What I shared last week, now my experience is approximately 10,000 people with social anxiety, many hundreds of people of all ages with selective mutism, and many different degrees of it. Now, I do believe, I could be wrong, but I do believe that this clinical experience is probably more than any other therapist or organization in the world. And I know of some research that was done, and the research that's basically been done with selective mutism has been so medicine-oriented. The whole issue of therapy and parenting issues has been so left out of it because it's such a misunderstood phenomenon. But the issue of medicine is extremely important. Now, what we have seen that works is when the parents have made substantial progress with the corrective parenting methodology. That's what Delia was just describing as the non-enabling, the empowering versus non-enabling, not thinking for the child, not speaking for the child, but learning to do this in a systematic way. If at a certain point into the process, and in my work, it's usually about 3 months if the work is really good, if the child is frozen, if the child is overly inhibited, we will at that point integrate medicine into the therapy, but only then. Someone from Sugarland, Texas writes, can selective mutism be treated without any medication? In some cases, yes. In some cases, yes. And in many cases, medicine is absolutely needed. And in order to elaborate more on this subject, we have with us Dr. Robert Luttrell, MD, who does great work for us. He's worked with Behrendt Associates as our consulting physician for, I think it's over 10 years at this point. So I thank you for your time, and I'm going to ask you some point-blank questions, which hopefully you can answer. So here we go. Number one, how effective are the selective serotonin reuptake drugs for selective mutism, and what are the side effects?
The selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are very, very effective. I don't think we've seen many failures at all. And they are the drugs of choice in all the literature that I've read. And certainly in my clinical experience, they work the best. They have very minimal side effects, which is lucky. 9 out of 10 10 kids who take them feel absolutely nothing. Maybe 1 out of 10 gets the first 3 days they take the medicine, a little bit of a headache, a little bit of a dry mouth, or a touch of nausea. But it quickly can be handled by cutting the pill in half or the dosage in half. And after 4 days, it usually goes. The body's used to the newness of the drug, and then the body adapts and goes on at full strength. So they're very effective, and there's minimal side effect.
What do they actually do?
SSRIs raise the serotonin in the brain. Now, we know much more about the brain chemistry in the last 10 years than we ever knew before. And we know that there are some certain substances up there called neurotransmitters, of which serotonin is one, norepinephrine is another, dopamine is one, GABA is one. These are the ones that are all clinically significant. Serotonin has to do with anxiety and some depression. When the brain gets a signal from a psychological mechanism that it's upset, the serotonin sinks down because it's all being absorbed by the presynaptic neurons. And the SSRIs go in and stop that absorption by plugging up little receptor sites on the neurons. And then the serotonin rises up between the neurons, and the person feels calm, relaxed, and talkative. So that's the way they work.
Have there been any recent studies on the long-term effects, on the effects of children?
No. The long-term studies are not in very much in selective mutism literature. However, we do have literature from social anxiety and from treating obsessive-compulsive kids over long periods of time, and we have not run into long-term difficulties of any sort. Prozac, for instance, has been with this country for 15 years and 8 years before that abroad, so that's over 21 years, and there have been no late-term difficulties with it, with selective mutism or social anxiety or obsessive-compulsive illness.
Why is Prozac the drug of choice usually for selective mutism?
Well, it's the drug of choice because it's the only SSRI that is slightly stimulating, and that makes a child want to talk. And even adults, when they're given Prozac, tend to talk more. And the others are not stimulating or slightly sedating, so they don't have the same effect. So Prozac has the edge, although the others will work, and the others I might mention are Zoloft, Paxil, Celexa, Lexapro, and Luvox. They'll all work, but Prozac really has that stimulating edge, which makes it the drug of choice.
Okay, now just so that we can really be accountable, Dr. Luttrell, you know, Prozac, we've seen in our practice, Prozac usually works quite well when used the right way, and the right way is as a tool for therapy and with medical supervision. But just to cover all the bases here, there is a downside of Prozac. Could you just share that?
The downside of Prozac?
Yeah.
Well, if every drug has some reaction, the side reactions that I gave are there. If a child needs it over a year, he might gain a little weight. If he gets very sensitive to stimulation, he might get activated and get too active and be somewhat of a behavior problem, but those are very rare instances.
Okay. Why is other medication, in the small percentage of cases that other medicine in the SSRI family other than Prozac is used, why is that?
There are other meds that have been in the literature that have been tried. Buspar, which is a tranquilizer, benzodiazepines such as Valium and Clonopin and Xanax have been tried. And some later new drugs, which are atypical major tranquilizers, such as Abilify and Geodon, have also the effect of raising the serotonin, so they are somewhat effective, but they have so many side effects that they're not in common use at all.
This question wasn't on the list, but what would you say to parents who want to think that medicine is the answer?
I mean, only medicine or not?
Yes, yes.
Oh, all studies show that the combination of behavioral therapy plus the medicine work better than either alone. That's almost every researcher's conclusion. They've run kids through with just medicine, kids just with psychotherapy of some sort, and none of them worked as well as medicine plus therapy.
Okay, a couple more questions. Here's a direct question. from a participant. My daughter is 12 and has been a selective mute since a toddler. At age 5, I had her on meds for 1 year and saw very little improvement and a big change in attitude and meanness. I want to try meds again, and my daughter does not want to. Should I press the issue? What do you think?
I would say absolutely. Here she is without medicine or therapy, and she's still selectively mute at a very late age. A lot of the kids have gotten better by that time, and she's one of the ones that's been resistant and not improved. So I would think that she ought to go back for a reevaluation and see if there are other factors that prevented her from just getting well, but she's getting nowhere without treatment. So I would certainly suggest trying meds and therapy again.
Can the medicine sometimes cause over-aggressiveness in children?
I had an example of that recently because the kid had ADD at the same time that he had selective mutism, and he was already off the walls with activity, and I put him on a little bit of Prozac, and he started punching other kids in school in kindergarten. So I quickly pulled out the Prozac and put him on Zoloft, which is not stimulating. So that was a rare example, though.
Okay. Last question. One person writes, what do you think about Klonopin for treating an adult selective mute?
Well, Klonopin is good because it relaxes people, and if anxiety is what was the difficulty is here, that ought to help a lot. The reason we don't use it as much is that Klonopin day in and day out will get you feeling very drugged after a while. So, and you're trying to cover usually an adult like that, maybe 16 hours a day, 8 hours of work, and maybe 4 hours at home, and that's an awful lot of Klonopin to take. So the SSRIs are advisable because they lower the anxiety level all 24 hours and with just one pill,
and
there's no druggy feeling.
And the SSRIs are more of a structural drug, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they do work on three things. They work on anxiety, obsessiveness, and depression.
That is true.
Okay. Listen, we could go on forever about medicine. It's a very complicated situation, but I think you covered all the bases quite well. I thank you very much for your time. If anybody wants to reach Dr. Luttrell directly, go into the website at selectivemutismseminar.com. You can see some information about him and his phone number, his address, and all that kind of stuff. Thank you very much, Dr. Luttrell.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, I want to just say one thing about the medicine. Again, there's a right and a wrong way to use medicine, and one of the things that I'm especially passionate about is when I do radio and TV shows, I try to get across the point that there is a lot of clinically criminal behavior with medicine going on. If you are giving a selectively mute child or an individual with social anxiety medicine without the right kind of help, it's really criminal. I really strongly believe that people who prescribe this brand of medicine should be psychopharmacologists or psychiatrists. And when it's in the hand of general practitioners, it's a more difficult thing. They are responding a lot directly to the marketing efforts of the pharmaceutical companies. And we live in an age of specialty. And it's the psychiatrist and psychopharmacologist who understand the chemistry of the brain more to more productively prescribe. And quite frankly, if you're going to bathe the child's brain in chemicals, it's really important to know how to do it the right way. I hope I have made my point with medicine. Again, we like to do our work without it, but when it's needed, it can be really great. Okay, now, one of the things that I have seen very clearly is that there's so many complications in the school. I mean, the school is a whole other issue. But so many people are so frustrated about not only, you know, the clinical issues in the school, but what their rights are. So to help you understand this, I've invited Mark Wilco, lawyer, who's here in Jericho, New York, to help us out with some of these issues. How are you doing, Mark?
Hi, how is everything, Jonathan?
Good. Okay, so you want to start? You want to start with what we were talking about the other day, the basic overview?
Absolutely. Well, how I thought I'd present this would be as a basic overview as your individual rights with respect to your children of school age as to what the schools must do with respect to both selective mutism and also generally any other disability, any other special need that a child might have.
Okay.
Many of you may be familiar, the preeminent statute, which affects all the states, is called the Individuals with Disability Education Improvement Act, the IDEIA of 2004. That guarantees every single child free, appropriate public education. And it requires that certain procedures be followed which are necessary to determine what is appropriate for the treatment of every student, of every child, no matter what their disability is. And there have been specific issues with respect to selective mutism which have been addressed by schools as to what they have to do. First, the school must perform an appropriate evaluation. They must get in specialists. They must do whatever testing is necessary to be able to determine what exactly the needs of the student are going to be and are currently at the current time. Then, in conjunction with the parents, the school district must design what is called an individual education program, commonly called an IEP. And parent participation must be involved in all the decision-making. Contemporaneous with that is a parent's right to have their own testing done and to have their own experts involved and to have their own input as to what is needed. Lastly, the school districts must provide due process safeguards to ensure that what needs to be done is getting done. And I think that's probably the greatest area which I'll address is what you do in the event you feel that your child's needs are not being met by the IEP, the Individual Education Program, that has been designed for your child, and if you believe that your child is not receiving free, appropriate public education.
Okay, now, Mark, I just one question here. Is what you're explaining, does this apply to private schools or not?
It does not apply to private schools, but it applies to public schools. And if a parent chooses to go to a private school, there are instances where the public entities, the public school districts, must pay for that private education. Now, I was going to address some recent federal court decisions with respect to this issue at the end, but I'll address one of them in particular now. There is a recent Board of Education in the City of New York decision, which is in federal court, so it has, you know, wide-ranging implications. It was just decided this past January, and unfortunately it decided that if a child had not been receiving services in a public setting, a public school setting, that the school district was not entitled to receive tuition reimbursement, was not required to give tuition reimbursement for a private school. Now, there are a divergence of other court with respect to this issue, specifically on the topic of notice. There is at least one other court which has determined that as long as the school district was given prior notice of the parent's intention to go to a private school and didn't offer an alternative in a timely fashion which was reasonable, again, to provide the student with the free appropriate public education, then reimbursement was appropriate. Now, this case is being appealed. So the reality is that this is an open issue at the current time as to whether or not it will be required. But the easy answer then is first go to your school district. Unless for some reason a parent had a specific desire to send their child to a private school, especially for a child with some special needs, very often the school district will provide that for you and will obviously absorb the costs. So even in light of this recent case, if you had gone to your school district and had gone through the procedure there in an attempt to establish an IEP and get your child the appropriate education, then you could look to a private school which you felt and which you could prove had better capabilities for treating your child's needs. I hope that answers the question.
Okay, but I'm just throwing one other one in here, and then I'm
going
to let you finish your
presentation. No, not a problem.
Okay. A parent has a daughter, a child, in a private school. The private school does not understand what's going on with selective mutism. They will not accommodate the parent in terms of, you know, any treatment strategies in the classroom. In essence, they want to get rid of the child.
Okay.
Does the parent have any rights?
Now you're asking what would theoretically be a loaded question. It, under
Well, I don't want to make it easy for you.
Well, under the under the Individuals with Disability Education Improvement Act, the IDEIA of 2004, that would affect public education. However, there is another statute that parents need to be aware of, and that would be Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. It's been around for 25, 30 years, hasn't been used. It's a civil right law. It has its own enforcement through the civil rights, and that prevents widespread discrimination. Okay? Now, that law has been used to address both elementary, secondary education, colleges, universities, vocational schools, proprietary schools, libraries, museums, anyone else who receives federal funding, okay? Now, that's going to be the crux of where you have to go without going into the regular standard Americans with Disability Act, which would be the third statute, which could have some impact. And then making the appropriate complaints with respect to those. Now, again, those are not designed specifically for students. Those are general civil rights complaints that your needs aren't being met. I would also, hazard an opinion that with respect to private schools being compelled to provide these services, that this most private schools that I'm aware of are a fee-for-service institution, and they would have a great deal of protection under the law under the issue of, hey, you choose to come to us, you know what we have available. If it's not available, then it's not available, especially because they can always fall back and in reality use the IDEIA as a shield and say, you have a right to go to public education and to get this. So with giving you a long answer to the question, yes, there are things that you could potentially do with respect to a private school. However, your greater hammer is with your regular school district, the regular public, what we commonly call free education. And for those of us who pay taxes, no, it's not really free. And to compel them to, for want of using another word, do the right thing.
You know, I have to say, it sounds complicated a bit.
And the truth is, it can be. And I wanted to actually, in stepping through it, hopefully take a little bit of the complexity out of it. So in continuing with what I was talking about initially, the first level will be your IEP. It'll be the meeting where you sit down with the child's student, with the child's primary teacher, special education teacher, if there is a special education teacher, a speech pathologist, a therapist, all of the school-based support staff that might be there, also commonly known as the Committee on Special Education in most school districts. And you would determine appropriate goals that you need to meet and how you're going to reach those goals. And hopefully, the parents, in conjunction with the school district, will reach middle ground as to where you want it to be. Now, very often, the school district and the constraints that they have will want to give X, and the parent will want Y. And hopefully, you can reach somewhere in between X and Y where you're happy and you feel your child's being served. Where you reach another impasse would be if, for some reason, you believe your child is not being served. In that event, every single school district has a program for impartial hearings and mediation. Okay, that would be the next step up the rung. You would request an impartial hearing, disagree with the recommendations. You can bring in your own experts. There are time restrictions in every jurisdiction with respect to it. Under the IDEIA, it's 15 days from a request of a hearing for a parent as well as the committee to be notified of a hearing. If a resolution is reached, it gets reduced to writing. If for some reason it isn't reached, then a mediation hearing can then be held, which would be a more formal mediation hearing. And then in every jurisdiction, you'd have the right to then bring actual administrative proceedings, which would be a quasi-judicial proceeding. You would need to exhaust administrative remedies before being able to go to any court. I'll use as an example of the exhaustion of administrative remedies. There happened to have been a not so recent case, approximately 2 years old, in the state of New Jersey, where a school district on selective mutism specifically where in the state of New Jersey, a parent had a child with selective mutism. The child was approximately 7 years old at the time, six and a half years old at the time. The school district wanted to give one weekly session of group speech therapy. The parent went through the IEP procedure, told them that she wanted two individual half-hour sessions, something that, in all honesty, I wouldn't consider to be, you know, overly unreasonable. The school district rejected it. They rejected it in mediation and an alternative dispute resolution. The administrative action was brought, and the administrative hearing officer found clearly that the request was reasonable. The parent brought in their own testimony. The parent brought in their own testing that had been done. And pursuant to the Individuals with Disability Education Act, the IDEIA, the administrative hearing officer made determination that they had to provide a program that conferred sufficient educational benefits, and that the educational benefits that were being conferred to this student in the one group session per week was insufficient, and that based upon the evidence that the school district, and here's an important factor, did not institute an individualized, and that's the important factor here, an individualized program. And that, I feel specifically with selective mutism, is going to be a definitive factor in a lot of your requests to your school district. They may be treating this as any other form of, you know, disruptiveness in a classroom, potential autism, ADD, ADHD. They may try to lump it in and treat it how they've treated other students.
Very important point. Very important point.
And the important factor is that you are entitled, more importantly, your child is entitled to an individualized program. And that program must meet their needs. Now, you go to the next level. If the school district couldn't meet their needs and you were able to locate a school outside of the system, you could also seek that they place your student in that school and cover the expenses involved, including transportation, ancillary expenses, etc. And as I indicated initially, putting the cart a little before the horse, courts have ruled that school districts must do that. But again, I caution you that because of a divergence, if that was somewhere that you thought you wanted to go potentially with your child to, at a very minimum, make sure that your child is receiving some benefits, some services at the public education level. So that way you didn't reach a point where you go ahead and do it, and with the hope that they're going to pay the expenses at some point in time and reimburse you, and then you find that the court is turning, a court or administrative tribunal is turning around and saying, well, you know, we would have, but you didn't come to us first. So I would hate for someone to get into that situation.
Okay, I want you to, your information is absolutely very, very important, and I know there's a lot of people who want to hear more from you, and I want to hear more. I would like you to, just in a couple of minutes, if you don't mind, give them the other important points you have, because then I have to get on to some other stuff. I have limited time on the that I rented on the bridge here.
Not a problem. The truth is that because we put the legal avenues beforehand, I've actually addressed most of what I wanted to address. I also realize, like I said, that the most important factor here involved is that you go through the procedure, is that the schools have a procedure, and that at some point in time, if you feel that you are not receiving something you deserve, that you hire a professional, be that as an attorney, be that as a special education consultant, which are widespread out there, someone who knows how the system works in your jurisdiction. I'm giving you some general information, but every school district jurisdiction obviously works differently, and it's important to be able to locate an individual who is in your area who can then guide you and assist you, let you know what the school district has done previously, what you can push for, what you could expect to get, what you could not expect to get.
And let me ask you, and Mark, so if someone calls from Oberlin, Ohio, you know, or someplace, can you help that person?
I should be able to find a contact for virtually everyone across the country and be able to put someone in contact with someone in a nearby Jewish jurisdiction. Now, as you mentioned, someone in the middle of Tennessee, theoretically. I don't know if I'm going to find someone in their town for them.
But I will find someone
who, at a very minimum, is somewhere nearby, who is willing to address that town, hopefully, and who has some experience in this area.
Okay, one more quick question.
Sure.
This person writes, I experienced selective mutism as a child. Now, as an adult, I have social anxiety. Do I have any legal rights when looking for a job?
Americans with Disability Act. When that person would fall under a general provision under the Americans with Disability Act. Theoretically, if their job or what they were looking for involved some type of education, if they were trying to get training for a new job, potentially Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the act I mentioned before under the Civil Rights Act, might be helpful on that regard. But I would tell that individual to specifically address the ADA. All employers over a certain size must provide reasonable accommodations.
Okay, Mark, thank you very, very much. This is terrific information. If anybody wants to talk to Mark directly, he's in Jericho, New York. Go to the website, selectivemutismseminar.com. You'll see Mark Wilco Esquire, all the identifying information and how to reach him. I thank you very much for your time, Mark.
Excellent. Have a nice night, everyone.
Take care. Okay, now, I want to use the remaining time. What I've tried to do in this seminar what I said last time is my philosophy in life and my clinical philosophy is that time is your most valuable asset. So what I've tried to do in this 2 and 2.5 hours is to give you the most important, concise information to help you. So now I want to talk about the methodology. The methodology is based on the fact that we have, with selective mutism, an addiction to the avoidance of speaking. Now, I think you really got to understand what an addiction is. You know about addictions to drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling, smoking, the list goes on and on. In order to have an addiction, which is avoidance, I mean, here we're talking about avoidance, but any addiction in general, you have to have an enabler. What is an enabler? An enabler is the person who provides the money for the gambler, drugs for the drug addict, the talking for the selective mute. Now, I don't mean to be too harsh here, and I am not blaming parents, but what I am trying to do is to cut through the misconceptions and the confusion to get right to the core issue. I was having a conversation with one of my 19-year-old patients this afternoon who I gave him a copy. You can get this if anybody's interested on the website. It's free. All we do is ask for mailing of the Sally Raphael Show back quite a few years ago. And in that, I have a number of patients who were on TV. And I coined the phrase, an addiction to avoidance. And he was talking about his addiction to avoidance, having dropped out of college, a bright, good-looking guy, and realizing he's addicted to avoidance. And I'm going to tell you something, that it is a lot easier to deal with this addiction when the child is 6, 7, 8 than 18, 19, 20, or 29, 30, 31, because the anxiety works its way into the personality very insidiously, where you have the characteristics of avoidance and dependence. Therefore, if you understand what enabling is, in order to turn the situation around, rather, it is imperative to understand what enabling is. So, this is what you do. First, you ask yourself if I'm making sense. If I'm not making sense, I don't know what you're doing on the phone at this point. I'm sure there are some people who still don't want to buy what I'm saying because it may be controversial and it may be easier to think I want to take my child to the therapist. If the parents do not acknowledge their role in this with a young child, it is very hard. I'm not saying impossible. It is very hard to have success. So once you understand mutism as an anxiety disorder, once you understand the avoidance dependency syndrome and your role as an enabler, you're ready to go, assuming that you are on the same team, parents. And so frequently do I hear parents rationalize where a mother will say, you know, I'm the primary caregiver. Does my husband have to be, I hate to be sexist here, but does my husband have to be involved? Unless there's an extraordinary situation, and it would be hard to convince me of any, unless we're talking about a single parent. If you do not have both parents involved, the absence of one in following through on the strategy is nothing less than sabotage. So once you're past that point, what you do is you make a list, literally a list, of the ways that your child is overly dependent on you. Who do you talk for? When do you talk for him or her? How do you think for the child? How do you read the person's mind? How do you solve all the problems? Not that you're not going to be solving the problems for a six-year-old, but the more that you can empower the child to get into creative problem solving, the more at an early age, the more you're developing what I consider, what I refer to as a high performance mind. But understand something, as I was talking with this 19-year-old today, the reason that he is addicted to avoid is because when he starts thinking about how to get out of his comfort zone, anxiety comes in, uncomfortable emotions come in. These are the things he does not want to experience. People with anxiety disorders, many people, have learned how to detach, that's the operative word, to detach themselves from certain modes of thinking and from feeling specific emotions. The more that goes on, the harder it is to reverse. It just gets worse and worse over time. So you make this list, and this is your most important tool. And then what you do is very, very slowly, very slowly, you know, 1% at a time, you start cutting back on the enabling. You start, as Delia was saying earlier, freezing the moment when someone comes up and talks to the child. Your reflex is, I'm going to talk to the child. You don't want to feel uncomfortable. You don't want to have the child feel uncomfortable. Well, you go from 1 second of not responding to 3 seconds to 5 seconds to 7 seconds, and you spread this out over time as a methodology. A little bit at a time. You want to read the child's reaction to this. How much stress is the child feeling? One letter that, okay, the person writes, okay, my son just turned 4. He loves to go to school but will not talk to the teachers. I've been putting pressure on him to talk. Remember what I said last time. I'll reiterate in a minute. Without realizing that what I was doing was pressuring him. His new answer is, as to why he won't talk in school, is I'm shy. That's great. Now, this is where parents have to learn how to be therapists, because when the child verbalizes something like, I'm shy, the child is beginning to express feelings. So that gives the parents a door to open. Tell me about your shyness. What do you feel when you're shy? Now, the more that the child can start expressing at home, the more that's going to go a long way in reducing stress and anxiety. Anytime you can extract feelings from the child, it's very nurturing, it's very empowering. And remember what I said last time, for those of you who are coming into the seminar for the first time tonight, from this point on, you don't ask the child, are you going to talk? You don't pressure the child to talk. Please talk. Don't beg. Don't panic. Don't show your anxiety. What you want to do is you want to set up a system of expectations that the child is expected to try. Okay, that's the key word here, to try to talk, to problem solve, to think independently on an age-appropriate basis. When you see the trying, you're halfway there. And as I said before, when the child is really trying and stuck, that's when medicine comes in. You don't do medicine before you get the trying. Or it breeds over dependence, which is the pathology. I hate to use the dirty word. Pathology means disease. We have a disease of overdependence. So slowly but surely, you empower the child to get in, to access the part of the mind that he or she usually does not do. One person writes, is selective mutism a biochemical problem, a nutritional problem, whatever? There are biochemical issues to everything in life. And when you say that this social anxiety or selective mutism is a biochemical problem, yes, there are physiological components to it without a doubt, and there is a genetic predisposition. But going in the direction of biochemical is, that's the problem, is you're going to be investing in the disability and not empowering the child. The reality is that selective mutism is a psychological and emotional problem with physiological characteristics based on the avoidance-dependent syndrome, which is very common in social anxiety. It's a phobia for speaking. So when you're teaching the child that they have to adjust to reality, not the other way around, you're nurturing. This will create stress for the child. The more that there is a selective mutism, the more it's been part of the lifestyle, the more the stress is going to be when you're reversing the situation. That's why when you can get to the children when they're 4, 5, 6 years of age, it's a lot easier. You do not want to accommodate the illness. This is where the parents become confused. They think that nurturing is accommodating. If I minimize the stress in the child, I'm nurturing the child. Well, there's good stress and bad stress. And when the child gets used to the accommodation, you're teaching bad stress. They learn that to be a way of life. Now, lots of people had questions about the school. And I'm going to tell you what you're not going to want to hear. It is unlikely that you are, for many reasons, that you're going to, nurturing also means to have, there's many different aspects of nurturing. Parents have to nurture themselves, and part of it is to have realistic expectations, because if you don't have realistic expectations, you'll set yourself up for more anxiety and distress. To think that schools and teachers and school psychologists are going to be able to reverse selective mutism in the classroom without the parents doing what is necessary in the home is ridiculous. It's just not realistic. There have been some situations, this is the small percentage, of situations where some technique here and there will help empower the child over the, out of the comfort zone and into success in a relatively short period of time. For most of selective mutism, it is a very deep structural problem. So to think of just technique, a little technique here and there, I mean, it's not going to work. And teachers vary, and this is why Mark's presentation was so important. Schools and teachers vary in their openness to working with the selectively mute child. The right thing in the classroom for the child is to have a scenario where the teacher is doing what the parents are doing. They are developmentally, systematically not doing enabling behavior. Ellen talked about that last time, where her son David went to school. They wanted to teach him sign language, or they said, David, if you can't talk, write. Okay, that's easy for the teacher, and you understand why with 30 kids in the class, but it's enabling. Any time that you're accommodating the illness, you are enabling. Often, as Delia did and Lynn last week, they advocated in the school for myself and one of my associates to work with people in the school to teach them what to do. Some schools are open, some schools are not. But you have to understand that it takes some time to restructure the structural nature of the problem. One conversation with a confused parent a couple of weeks ago saying, the teacher's a professional, she should know what to do. Should's a big word. The only bigger word is if. And social anxiety in general, even though the term is used, a lot these days, is still it mystifies the professional community. Selective mutism even more so. So when you think of writing me, and every day I get emails, where can I go in Houston, in Denver, in Sacramento, in wherever, to find a specialist? I don't think there are any. That's why I'm doing this seminar, is to help you with the information that you as a parent need. When you take the kid to a speech therapist, when you take the child to one-on-one therapy without involving the parents, it's absolutely ridiculous. But it's a hard thing to process, in that if it's in your hands. It's in your hands, parents. At the risk of some of you getting angry and confused, it's in your hands. And I did my best tonight to give you, tonight and last week, to give you interviews from parents. I wonder if there are any other interviews available anywhere of parents who can say, my child has resolved the problem with selective mutism, my child is cured. This is very hard stuff to find. You heard the answers from these parents. Now, I'm going to try something risky here for a couple of minutes. I'm going to open the lines, and we're going to see if there's any good questions. If it's not a good question, I'm not going to stay with it. So first come, first serve. Lisa, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, so what do I do? Star 5?
Star 5.
Okay, here we go. I need my assistant to help me. I have my own performance anxiety here. And that, by the way, selective mutism is performance anxiety. Here we go. Okay. Anybody want to ask a question?
Hello, Doc.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead. First one, the man.
Hi, Doc. How are you?
Okay.
My daughter is selectively mute in school, but outside of school, she'll talk to her friends. They'll come over the house. They'll talk. Like we were seeing a therapist, she talks to the therapist and the at the therapy place and everything like that. But once she's in school, she started whispering to the teacher, but she won't talk in front of the kids like a group thing.
Right.
So, like, we're at a sticking point.
I want you to turn your thing off. I have to go back to. See, that's the problem with opening up the lines. There's a lot of background noise. Okay, this situation points out the issue that selective mutism is a relative. There are different degrees to the problem. Okay, this person's child is better than a lot of selective mutes. But when the number one fear in America is fear of public speaking, selective mutism is a definitive precursor to that. So what's happening is that this child is having specific performance anxiety in the class. So what's theoretically the objective is to nurture the child's participation by non-enabling and for the teachers to come across as supportive and reinforcing. But I gave an example last week. When the child starts talking, and the whispering, that's a good bridge. The whispering is better than total muteness. When the child talks, you don't say in front of everybody, great, because that's exactly what the selectively mute child does not want. Okay, it puts more attention on them. So you are gradually and subtly nurturing them into the mainstream, building on the whispering. Okay, taking it to the next level. The teacher could possibly do some one-on-one work with the child, not one-on-one work, but talk to the child individually and say, would they maybe contract with the child, would you like me to try to call on you here and there? And to find out what the child wants, to see if the child will express some feelings and thoughts to the teacher. Let's try another one. Listen, if you have any background noise going on that you're aware of, please try to get rid of it. I'll try one more time here.
I have a question.
Hi, next question, go.
Should a teacher be taking yes or no answers as nods?
Should they be responding to a nod?
Right. The teacher is acknowledging that the child is saying yes or no, but only in a nod.
Hold on. I'm going to unmute. I'm going to mute again. Okay, good question. You have to look at the developmental sequence of things. For a while, the nodding is okay, but the objective is that's the behavior you want to extinguish. But this is where it gets very tricky, because you have another class. I mean, you have other kids in the class. So if the teacher isn't responding to a nod, what happens in the class? You know, everything is frozen, you know. How long can she do that? I don't know. That's where you may want to contract with the teacher. But the ultimate advice is you want to get to the point where the nodding is not accepted. You don't want to do it tomorrow. All of a sudden, tomorrow I will not accept nodding. You want to prepare the child, okay? But nodding, accepting the nod, is a form of enabling behavior. Okay, let's try it again. Next, go.
Hello?
Yeah, go.
Yes, I heard you speak of your patient that's 19. I have a 19-year-old son.
Yes.
And he's suffering from selective mutism, but he won't really admit it to himself, but he's avoiding a lot of social situations.
Right.
And I'm getting more and more concerned because he's getting older.
Okay, I'm going to answer in a minute. I'm going to mute again. Okay, good question. Very typical scenario. The 19-year-old has anxiety, and they can't admit it to themselves. They're in denial. I could give you literally 1,000 stories like this, and we're going to come back to the basic concepts that are so confusing. We are not going to do yourself a favor. Again, nurture yourselves, have the right expectations. Don't expect this child to have initiative. Remember, initiative is not ability. It means to start up. Therefore, what you need to do as parents is you need to say to yourself, this problem is only going to get worse if I, as a parent, do not learn what to do. What you need to do is to teach this child how to survive in life, because right now he doesn't know how to. And there is a thin line between illusion and delusion. Illusion means that the person is confused. Delusion means that the person is not in reality. What happens is the more that parents enable this kind of lifestyle, the more the children start thinking, well, you know, this is the way life is going to be. My parents are always going to be here to take care of me. When I was on the Oprah Winfrey Show many years ago, one of the women I had on was she had her first date at age 38. And I don't remember if I told this story last time, but Oprah couldn't believe this. and Oprah was getting calls from the listening audience, you're browbeating this person whose name was Susan. And she says, no, I'm not browbeating her. I just don't understand. Were your parents so much fun you wanted to just hang out with them? Okay, the parents have to understand, you have to learn a strategy to empower your child out of the comfort zone to learn how to survive in this world, or they will always be dependent on you. And that the problem here can go very deep, because the 19-year-old with a substantial problem doesn't want to talk about their thoughts, feelings, and doesn't want to invest in getting well other than by magic, because they have to do work, and it's not easy to do the work necessarily. So that's why the parents need to clearly understand where they're going in this life with their adult children. You know, a lot of children who are adults, even though they can't verbalize it, people who really have a lot of social avoidance and related pathology, deep down they think, it's my parents' fault. They created me. This is heavy, okay? And they have to do what I want. And the opposition can become very deep, and so can the anger become very deep. And with the people that I have had high degrees of success with anxiety and related problems, every one of these people to some degree has had to work through their anger. Now, what happens as a parent is when you have the little kids who are children and they're susceptible to temper tantrums, that's exaggerated emotion, that's anger coming out. When typically, if you're relating to the 19-year-old or the 27-year-old, like you just described, and you start a process of, you know, healing and empowering, they're not going to say, thank you very much for making me face my anxiety and helping me get well. They're going to probably be angry, and they're going to try to disarm you. And anger is expressed in two ways. One is acting out overtly, or the more difficult way to deal with it is when people start internalizing their anger and they get more depressed when pressure is put on. But nevertheless, if the parents do not learn how to negotiate this resistance and defense, you will be stuck and the problem will continue to get worse over time. Okay, I hope that this seminar has been helpful. There were 100 people the first time. There were 100 people tonight. I think that says something pretty positive. Anyway, I want to leave you with some thoughts. There are options available to you. Number one, this seminar is going to be available on audio in a couple of days. Number two, there is a two-hour self-help audio specifically for parents of children with selective mutism. Number three, there is group mentoring where you are on the phone in a small group, kind of like tonight with this technology, and, you know, that's another option. And as I said last time, there are some spaces for family therapy available, but there's very few of them. You will be receiving information about this. It will be up on selectivemutismseminar.com within a couple of days, all of this. And as I said, if you need Dr. Luttrell or Mark Wilco, lawyer, you can get their information on the website. So I leave you all with the thought that the problem is very resolvable. It's very resolvable, but it's in the hands of the parents, because the selectively mute individuals, children, don't have initiative. They have an addiction to avoidance. The reason they have that is because of their anxiety and because of the enabling. The more that you wait to not intervene, the more potential there is for the social anxiety to get worse, for depression to appear, and for things like career dysfunction and academic problems to really develop. You know, one person asked last week, how do selectively mute adults handle it in the workplace? Good question. Many don't work. You heard Mike last week say how a bright individual, you heard him describe how he decided not to go to college because he wasn't able to talk because of his anxiety. But the good news is that there is hope, there is an answer, it is resolvable, you've got to take action, and there are many options for you. So I thank you all for attending, and I hope this has been helpful. See you soon, hopefully.